Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to The River. This is Tom Fuller coming to you from beautiful Portland, Oregon, with my friends and your hosts, authors Maxine Marcellini and Jeannie St. John Taylor. Every Monday, Maxine and Jeannie get together to share what's on their hearts with listeners around the world. They chat with other authors and friends on a wide variety of topics. Some bring a laugh, some cause us to wipe away a tear, but all of them send rivers of blessing into our lives. These shows can be life-changing if our hearts are open and allow the river of God's love to pour into our deepest needs. So, listeners, are you ready? Now's the perfect time for me to stop talking and let the ladies take us on today's exciting journey down the river.
Welcome, listeners. We're so glad you've joined us today. This is Jeannie St. John Taylor here with my friend and co-host Maxine Marcellini. Maxine, I'm so glad to be able to talk to you on the air today. How are you?
Well, I feel the same way. I'm doing quite well. I just came off of a nice weekend ladies retreat in Cannon Beach where Poppy Smith was a speaker, and we really learned about life in the pits and how to make those pivotal turns that take you out of those pits and wait on the Lord. And it was excellent. The weather could not have been more perfect. So, beautiful weekend. So I'm doing great. How about you?
Well, great, except I think this is our last perfect day. Did you know our weather's... We both live in Portland, Oregon, and our weather is not supposed to be this warm, but it's absolutely a gorgeous day. We're getting up into the 80s today, right?
I think so. It was so warm yesterday. I believe we're going to have more of it.
We'll find out in a second where our guest, Elisa Jordan, lives. She is the founding director of the Society of the Justice Society, which is a 501(c) nonprofit that develops preventive and restorative enterprises for exploited and trafficked communities. Elisa's passion for justice has propelled her to go to dark places to help provide sustainable jobs, places of safety, and education for those who have been overlooked and exploited. She's also a regular speaker on the subject of domestic and international sex trafficking. Her motto is simple: hate evil, love good, do justice. However, living it out's not for the faint of heart. Elisa's work spans multiple nations and various social issues, but her focus remains clear. She stands against injustice and empowers others to do the same. If you're called to do justice but don't know where to begin, you can go to the Justice Society at www.justicesociety.org and get connected, or listen to us today as we talk to our guest, Elisa. Welcome, Elisa.
Thank you, Maxine and Jeannie. I'm delighted to be here with you.
We're so glad to have you. Hey, Elisa, where do you live?
I live in Dallas, Texas.
So you have warm weather, too.
And crazy rain the last couple of days. Yes.
Are you
very
serious?
Warm weather, but torrential rain. It's been torn roofs off of buildings.
Wow.
How in the world?
That's what we're all asking out in the world.
And you guys have had a drought for so long, right?
Oh, we have. So it's been good. The rain has been really a blessing, but some other things came with it.
Yeah.
Just leave the roofs on the buildings, huh?
Yeah.
That's kind of rough when it gets that stormy.
Yeah. Hey, Elisa, can we start today with, do you want to explain who, first of all, is trafficking a huge problem in the United States? And then who is at risk? I mean, I can see people listening who saying, well, you know what, it really doesn't concern me or my children. So is it big in the United States, and who is at risk?
Yeah, well, that's the question I think most of us are asking, is it really happening here? And unfortunately, it is. It's a bigger problem than we realize. In 2008, the Trafficking in Persons report indicated that anywhere from 100,000 to 300,000 children a year, these are American children in the U.S., a year are being exploited through pornography and prostitution.
Wow.
So, when I heard those initial figures, that was just 2008. The numbers are a little higher now, but those are the statistics I can, you know, strongly provide you. But I will say, here's another recent example. In June, there was a multi-government sting, would be probably the best term for all of us, where it was FBI and all kinds of nonprofits and government agencies got together, and they did Operation Cross Country. And this was the eighth one they'd done, eighth one annually. And in this was just June of this year, 168 kids and 281 pimps were found. It was a week-long sting. And since they've been doing this, there have been 3,600 kids that have been found, and, you know, millions in assets. So we don't really think this is happening here, but it is. And your second question was, I think, will bring some clarity as to why it's happening here, is the vulnerability factors. Because when we think about it abroad, we think, it's just the culture, and they might accept that, and we don't do that here in the U.S. We don't accept our children being sold, so it doesn't happen. But it just looks a little different here. And most of what's happening is what's called a boyfriend syndrome scenario, which is, there's big money. Let me just back up. There's big, big money in this. And gangs are now, this is their method of choice in making money, is actually selling children. Mm. So we can talk a little more about that if you want. But what's happening is that our kids are so vulnerable, and a lot of it is broken families, broken homes, fatherlessness. I think those are some big factors. And what these traffickers are doing is they're just looking for vulnerable kids that they can draw in and seduce, and just in relationship, you know, just becoming a boyfriend or meeting any need these children have. And with that, then luring them into, you know, sexual activity around this. And I touched on a lot of things, and we can go deeper in any of them you want to, but when we think of our American kids, it's not just the children who come from broken homes. I'm seeing it in middle-class neighborhoods and middle-class families, and I think one of the biggest things is that we have a very hyper-sexualized culture. So when we're thinking about how are they getting these kids, how's that happening, when our culture is so sexualized and it's a norm, and kids, even good kids, are having sex at 12 and 13, it's a pretty fine line for a lot of these kids who are already very sexually active to move into doing that for money. And I think for a lot of us, I'm 51, and that just was, I mean, it was black and white in our day. I mean, you know, but it's not so much anymore with the culture in this generation. Everything's just a little gray and a little blurred. So with that, this moving into it for receiving something of value out of it just doesn't hold the same kind of shock factor as it did for us.
Hmm. Well, Lisa, I know Portland, Oregon, where Gene and I both live, is a really hot spot for sex trafficking.
It
has been in our news. Yes. It's been one of the cities where it is happening, and we know that. What you just surprised me with, though, is that there's gang involvement going on. And so what do gangs do? Target somebody to go and get and then sell? I mean, what's the basic price that they get out of this?
Yeah, well, what's happening is we know that any type of gang, whether that's Russian mafia, I don't know if you ladies are familiar with the MS-13, but that's big. It's big all over the U.S.
No, I'm not.
A lot of it's a gang that came. It actually was birthed in Los Angeles, but it's El Salvadorians in L.A., and it is nasty, nasty stuff. And the couple girls that I've worked with have directly come out of MS-13. What's happening is the gangs have actually said, I got this from the FBI, was that it is a perception that it's actually easier for them to make money through these kids than it is through selling drugs, because there is a perception that they are easier to manipulate, which shocked me, because I would think drugs don't talk back, drugs don't run away, right? But these kids are so easily, once they've been lured into the gang or decided to be in a gang, they have to be jumped in and go through violence, and they experience such traumatic violence in gangs that it's very, very easy. And they just say, this is what you're going to do. They literally have a snippet in the book that talks about they take, one gang took the girls door to door in an apartment complex.
Elisa, can you make your voice a little bit clearer? Can you
sure.
come closer to your, there you go.
Does that help? You bet.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
So what the gangs did was they actually got a group of girls that were gang members, brought them into an apartment complex, and had the girls knock door to door. They'd have a big bouncer behind them.
Are you kidding
and
they'd me?
And they charged $30 for 15 minutes in the apartment complex. So it's really brazen these days, astounding. And it is big money. So when we're talking big money, we're saying a pimp or trafficker earns anywhere from $150,000 to $200,000 per child a year. Typically run anywhere from 3 to 6 girls at a time. And usually these kids will have a quota of about maybe 500 or more a night that they have to bring in. So it is big money. Yeah.
And how old are they?
Average age of entry is between the ages of 12 and 14 years old. And even women now that are involved in prostitution, many of them got started at young ages.
Oh, it just breaks your heart to hear so much of it going on and to know that they're being targeted. So where do they keep these girls? Where do they, or the young people? Because they're not all girls, right?
That's right. That's right. They really aren't all girls. Statistically, there isn't a lot of information on how many boys, but I've heard anywhere from, 20 to 50% are boys. It looks a little different with boys. Girls will typically be lured in by a pimp and a trafficker, and they will stay and work with him. And boys work independently most of the time on the streets on their own and aren't working with a trafficker. So they're much harder to find. Yeah. And
No, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to ask, please ask that second question again that you have.
I don't remember what it was, but now I remember, unless it was Maxine. Now I remember another question that I have. You talked about them going door-to-door in an apartment complex. Do they then take them out of the apartment, or is it possible that they stay in there the apartment of a parent who's off working and doesn't know and have do business there? Do you know the answer to that? I thought, oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that specific question, but I think that was, Maxine, your other question is how do they keep them?
How do they house them?
It looks very different in each case. Now, there are cases where there have been some children and women actually caged like animals and horrific things that put your brain on tilt. But that's not typically what it looks like. What happens is that these guys are looking for vulnerable young girls. And it's mostly girls, so that's what I'm talking about now today, because that happens to be the majority certainly that we're seeing. And what they're looking for is they are going to look for those that they even recruit in malls and different places. They're going to look for a girl. And I've had pimps say that they will literally look a girl in the eye and say something like, oh, you're cute. And if she looks him back in the eye and has kind of that self-esteem and is able to be somewhat confrontational toward him, he's going to move on to the next girl because he's looking for an easy mark. Someone who maybe has some low self-esteem, doesn't consider herself attractive, is kind of enamored by this older guy, she's a little older, giving her this attention. So what he will do is he will establish some kind of relationship. This is what most of it looks like in the U.S. He will befriend this child to some degree. And we're talking about 12 and 14-year-olds, so they're easily manipulated, believe what they hear, just vulnerable in so many ways. So he'll start to dialogue with her. And most of these kids will tell these guys everything that's going on in their lives, literally. And when that happens, what he's doing is he's very intentionally listening to what it is she needs. And when he figures that out, whether she needs kind of a father figure, she wants a boyfriend, she just wants to get out of the house and need some place to stay, whatever that is, he will intentionally insert himself into her life to meet that need. It could be 6 hours. It could be some of them even will recruit these kids for 6 months until the time comes when he knows, I have her. And, pimp quotes throughout the book, they talk about, when you get into their head enough, they'll follow you to hell. It's all about psychological manipulation and control. So then this child thinks that this guy is a boyfriend. Most of them will call them a boyfriend. Thinks that this guy is a boyfriend. And when he says, honey, this is what I need you to do. I need you to earn some money for us. usually she's going to say, I really don't want to do that. And he'll say, you know, we really need you to do this. Come on, you can do it. She does it. She does it for the first time. And then the relationship shifts. And I am answering the question about where these girls are kept. This is important to understand, though, so you can see how they're kept. So then that happens, and then he shifts. Because his whole purpose of befriending her and meeting her need was for this moment. So after that happens, he then turns on her and says, now you're nothing but a whore, and I need you to do this, and this is what you're going to do. Now what she's looking for is that relationship back, right? Because he's developed the relationship long enough that he is meeting a need that she has, a serious need she has, whatever that is. And so all she is doing is trying to figure out, how do I get back into his good graces and get into that relationship? So most of these kids, ladies, that we see, they do not consider themselves victims. Most of them will say, I chose to do this.
Oh.
We're talking about 12-year-olds. I chose to do this. Mm. He's my boyfriend. I'm not leaving. So they don't even see it as a victimization. There are cases where children have been kidnapped. One of the stories, there are 5 stories in the book. One of them is like that, where she actually was kidnapped and was held for 8 days, and the FBI broke down the door. All the rest look like some form of control and manipulation, where then this child in some way is, and I hate to say a willing participant, but because, you know, that's pretty loose terminology for a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old or even a 16 or 18-year-old, but that's what it looks like. So now a lot of them, what happens is they begin to go what's called automatic, and that means he doesn't even have to be around. That pimp can be in another city, and that girl's going to go out and do her job. She's going to bring that money in, and she's going to give it to him because she's on automatic. It becomes a way of life, and she's, you know, psychologically, traumatically, she's just bonded to this guy. You know, there might be fear if she leaves of retribution toward her, but most of the time she genuinely is thinking, you know, this is her boyfriend, and this is the way it's going to be.
That is absolutely stunning.
Yeah,
that is absolutely
very frightening. Now, you also say that most trafficking victims die within 7 years of being trafficked. That's almost more frightening than what we're hearing now. Why do they die?
Well, think about living on the street. These kids, oh my gosh, their stories. I didn't even put half of it in the book, you know, because I interviewed all 5 of them. But the things that they endure, oh my gosh. I mean, you know, everything from physical abuse, obviously, to sexually transmitted infections, to malnutrition. She typically doesn't eat except what he gets her, right? And, but, you know, any nature of that, it's very, very violent work, and their bodies are so, when we're talking about young children, they are so just destroyed in so many ways. Yeah. Very, very emotionally and physically abusive.
You know, I'm wondering what you could say to parents about watching for their own children. I mean, how do they know if they are or aren't at risk, especially when it's the boyfriend syndrome thing? That sure takes it out of the kidnapping and the, you know, the, oh, we're from a good family thing. How do they recognize that even in their family, the child might be at risk?
Well, let me give you one of the stories out of the book, because this is this is pretty alarming. This young girl, she was 16 at the time, and was a little bit developmentally slow. That's another thing a lot of these traffickers will look for. So she couldn't and didn't read social situations really well. Ken's from a very loving home, middle class. The mother's aware of this. So kind of the mom was told me in the interview time, she said, I really was a helicopter mom. She hovered over her kid, you know, and really watched. Well, this young man from high school that her daughter knew came over for dinner that night, and he had already set all this up. Came over for dinner, had dinner with the mom, the dad, the family, the girl, everybody. The boy says to the young girl, ask your mom if we can go to a store and get a soda. So she does, and her mom says, sure, honey. Her mom works the night shift. She's a nurse, and she says, I just want you to text me when you're on the way home. Just come straight home. And the girl knew that those were the rules. So they go get a soda, and while they're waiting in the parking lot after they get the soda, he's acting a little strangely, because she says, okay, are we ready to go home? And he said, you know, I just need to sit here a little bit. I'm waiting for a text to come back. And she didn't really gauge it rightly, but, you know, so a few red flags going on. All of a sudden, an SUV pulls up behind them, and it's two young kids that he knows, but she doesn't. They want to go to a party. Now, she knows her mom's a helicopter mom, and she knows she shouldn't go. But he says, I'm not going to go, but you go. They'll drop you off home. She goes. They put a date rape drug in. They had set all of this up. They then transferred her to another trafficker who then drove her out of state, out of the city, but kept her within state. But in this case, this mother was alert, was aware, had this young boy in the house for dinner, and her daughter already knew the rules. She really needed to come home after, you know, they got the soda, but she didn't. And so in this case, I would ask the mom, I said, oh, my gosh, what did you feel like? She said, you know, the only thing that saved my daughter was that I knew instantly when I didn't hear from her, I knew something was wrong. And so the mom got on it right away. And I think one of those keys was, which is hard to do, I have a 17-year-old son, and I don't know where he is every minute of every day, right? But really is knowing your children's friends. Now, in this case, that didn't do much good, but this is a highly unusual case. But who are these boyfriends? Who is your daughter hanging with? Is he older? Is he isolating her? Is she showing up with, you know, new phones and language that you've never seen before, clothes you haven't seen? I mean, just being aware in our children's lives, especially when they're getting a little bit older, when they don't want you in there anymore, right? But just being aware of who they're with and where they're headed and when you expect them home is really huge. Had this mom not jumped on it, I don't know that child would have ever been recovered.
So how did they catch up with these perpetrators?
You mean in that one story?
Yeah, in that story, because the mom might have known who the boyfriend was, but how did they actually apprehend those who'd taken her and get her back?
Yeah, well, first off, the first thing she did was she texted this young boy, and of course we're thinking, how could he not think that he would be implicated in this? But he really didn't. And he denied it. He said, oh, she went to the party, I knew nothing about it. And he never did say that he knew anything about it, so they couldn't actually convict him. But when she got there, they gave her a lot of NyQuil and kept her kind of foggy most of the time. And then they were posting her on the Internet, so men would come to the apartment door, and you know, that's where they kept her. In this case, one of the pimps walked out of the room and left his phone on the counter. She took the phone and she texted like a really almost groggy text to someone that wasn't even a close friend, but it was a number that she remembered. This friend gets this text and kind of blew it off because it didn't say help me, right? It was kind of garbled and in motel and, you know, just kind of hard to decipher until he finally hears from somebody else. She's been missing. So he reports immediately to the mom, who then takes it to the FBI she's already working with, and that's how they found this child. Had that not happened? And you can imagine once the pimp sees that she got to the phone.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
is
my
this
gosh.
The one, yes. Is this the one you considered a kidnapping?
Yes.
Mm. Okay.
But still, she was set up by somebody she knew, right?
Oh, yes.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yes, I was going to say,
right.
I wasn't even sure you'd call that a kidnapping because, although it was.
Yeah, that looked more like a kidnapping than any other case. But in almost all of them, there is some measure of a recruitment, some kind of a setup, and it's usually by somebody they know.
Okay, Alyssa, could you help us and our listeners understand what the Justice Society is doing to help restore those who've been taken into trafficking?
Sure. What we do is we work with a lot of organizations and agencies that are already doing work. I did a lot of safe home development many years ago, about 5 years ago. So I work closely with a safe home here in Texas. And I'm just delighted and honored to be helping a number of people in agencies in the U.S. and also abroad set up safe homes because, you know, there haven't been a lot of them in the last, you know, 10 years, only a few. And now there are a lot of homes springing up, but a lot of people don't really know how to do that work. So we definitely do that. But some of, I think, the most interesting programs that we've worked on are going into the court systems and being support for these kids while they're giving testimony against their pimps and traffickers. Mm-hmm. We did this at the request of our local DA's office. So I encourage your listeners, if there's anybody in Oregon who wants to, and you've got great programs that are working with the kids. I actually contacted some in Portland, some of the folks working on it. If they wanted to set up a team to do that in court, I would be happy to help them, you know, if you have any of your listeners. As well as we started with the juvenile justice system a mentorship program that was affiliated with a court for girls who had been brought in, minors that had been brought in on charges of prostitution. And that's really one of the keys, is can we get to these kids with mentorship? Unfortunately, in this case, they'd already brought in on charges of prostitution, but can we even develop mentorship programs in schools, in churches, and all of these places so that a lot of these vulnerable kids are, one, made aware, and parents are made aware, and two, that they have places that they can go. Most of these stories, a lot of these women said, you know, my teachers just didn't see it. They didn't ask. My parents didn't know to ask. Mm. You know, there's just that's missing in the lives of a lot of these kids. One, to be aware, and two, to have just really healthy relationships so they know what healthy looks like.
Listeners, we have been talking with Alisa Jordheim, The Sex Trafficking of America's Children. That's the name of her book. Alisa, is there something that we've missed that you really want to tell the listeners? Would you do that now, please? We're getting a little low on time.
Yeah. Yes, I will. I think that one of the most important things is when people hear this or just even hear about this subject, they say, well, what can I do? How can I help in this fight? And I really want to encourage everyone that you know what, it's not about quitting your job and starting a nonprofit or, you know, selling everything you have and giving your money to this fight. It's really about doing something within your own sphere of influence. Just have the most incredible stories about people. Let me give one example. I did a training here at the Dallas Independent School District, and one of the counselors was in the training. She called me the next day, and she said, I think I have one of these kids who's been trafficked sitting right in front of me in my counseling office. I said, you do? Okay, let's talk about what flags are you seeing. So she starts to tell me the indicators, and I said, I think you do. I'm going to call my contact in law enforcement, and I'm going to give him your number, tell him what we're seeing, and if he deems it that, you know, yes, enough flags, he'll call you. He does. This child had been trafficked across 3 state lines in just a couple months, and she had absolutely been trafficked. So this counselor is shocked. Right? Oh my gosh, I just got the training and now I literally was able to identify one of these kids and make a difference. So she started within the school. She went, you know, to her leadership and said, this is what happened. Can we bring some training in? And they said yes, and they worked it out and created a training. And now it's required in DISD that all the counselors, and this was just 2 years ago, all the counselors and frontline workers are getting training. So she didn't have to have all the answers. She just had to say, okay, here's my story. What can we do to make a difference? You know, there's one mom who was a stay-at-home mom with 4 kids, and she just said, I want to do something in the fight. She started making jewelry at home and donating the money. You know, another Girl Scout did that. A pediatric child abuse pediatrician went to some training and said, oh my gosh, I didn't even know this existed. Began to identify the kids now, you know, for not only abuse, but maybe some are being trafficked. And they decided to make flyers and distribute them in the apartments, bilingual flyers in their community. See, they just did a small thing in the community that was already something they could do and, you know, got a few folks together and said, let's do this. So it's very doable. There's any number of things you can do, and no thing in this fight is too small. No thing.
And
so I just encourage people
in
your want to
book,
do something.
In your book, The Sex Trafficking of America's Children, you have a list of those red flags, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure
okay.
Do.
And but, Maxine, do you have another question or something to add before
well,
we go?
Well, the only thing I want to say right now, because this is a subject that is far and wide, I am very grateful to Alisa that we are able to open it up deeper with our listening audience today and bring more awareness, and especially, you know, for the boyfriend-driven thing, part of that, and just becoming more aware and having parents prepare their children with knowledge. I think that's going to be key here. So thank you, Alisa, and I would definitely suggest that our listeners pick up this book, listen again to the tape, and go visit her site, which is the justicesociety.org. What is your site Alisa?
Justicesociety.org. Yes, justicesociety.org. And if they put in the code word justice, they can get the book for $10.
Wow.
Awesome. Thank you.
And the
for
book
being
is Made in the USA, the sex trafficking of America's children. Thank you so much, Elisa.
My pleasure. Thank you, ladies.
Yeah.
All right.
This is Tom Fuller saying thank you for joining us on The River today. I pray blessings have come your way. Please check out our hosts' websites to learn a little more about them. Maxine Marcellini is the author of Rebuilding Families $1 at a Time, Blended Families, and Raising Children in Blended Families. She's a life coach whose website, rebuildingfamilies.net, is full of family helps and resources. Jeannie St. John Taylor is the author and illustrator of more than 25 books for adults as well as children. You'll find her books, plus a link to read her newest biblical fiction, City of a Thousand Gods, on her website at jeanniestjohntaylor.com. All our programs are archived for later listening enjoyment. Consider posting a comment after today's show. And please let your friends know about what's happening at the river. Most of all, remember, you are never alone in this river called life. Jesus is with you and only a prayer away.